From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, getting off the grid and staying off it. Here's what's happening. Sadly, two more victims of Saturday's mass shooting in El Paso died on Monday morning, raising the number of fatalities to that massacre to 22. The mass shooting, one of the deadliest in modern U.S. history, unfolded at a Walmart around 11 a.m. Saturday as a 21-year-old suspect, Patrick Crecias, allegedly opened fire in the store, initially killing at least 20 and injuring 26. Crecias was booked on capital murder charges. Authorities said the crimes he accused of are being investigated as domestic terrorism. Officials are also looking into whether hate crime charges against him are appropriate. And, of course, in Dayton, Ohio, also several hours later, nine people dead in a mass shooting there. The shooter, of course, was killed by police who were on the scene. But what makes these young people do this? One was 21, the other was 24. Here's our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Breggin. Peter, another shocking story, my friend. What's happening?
Well, it's a continuing theme. One of the things I want to point out is that the shooter down south identified himself as some sort of white power, but the Dayton shooter identified himself as being a Democrat. So I'm more concerned right now about what in the world is going on in the political arena, specifically about what is going on. It isn't all about people just being disturbed, but a lot of it is about that. And I think that, you know, Trump brought up today the possibility of trying to identify earlier people who are just flagrant in their warnings and their threats.
Well, I guess, you know, if you could look at the postings of these individuals, you might be able to track something. But I'm not sure you can catch somebody like that, Peter.
Well, the Dayton fellow, you know, he had for several years had been a massive threat to people. He'd been found in high school to have a list of females to assault. Then he wrote a hot list on the wall. And then it's reported that on one day, I was amazed, in 2012, one third of the students skipped school because they were so afraid of him. I mean, that's bizarre.
And nobody did anything. Do we know anything about their medical history or their prescriptions or anything like that
at this time? The Dayton youngster talked about feeling psychotic and hearing voices. So he certainly was very disturbed. And, of course, he gave signals everywhere. He told a girl all about his voices that were very menacing to him. We don't know that either one of them had any psychiatric care or that either one of them were on psychiatric drugs.
Well, and let me ask you, Peter, as a psychiatrist, if either one of these two happened to have been a patient of yours and you picked up the possibility that they could do some harm to others, are you at liberty to talk to police about that or must it remain confidential?
Oh, you're compelled by law in just about every state of the union to take action to prevent harm from a patient of yours. So you actually would be obligated to get in touch with authorities and to say that this man was a risk. The law doesn't always say specifically what you must do, but you must take some kind of action. You can even warn if you know the victim, you can warn the victim, you can call the police, but you are obligated.
And, well, that's good to know, Peter, to be sure. And let's monitor these two episodes. One of the shooters, of course, is dead, but let's find out if they were on prescription drugs as well. A dramatic escalation of the trade war between the United States and China has sparked a worldwide sell-off in the markets on Monday. The Dow closed down 767 points. The Nasdaq Composite, a proxy of the technology companies that will be most harmed by a trade war, suffered its longest losing streak since November of 2016. Not good. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Mish Shedlock. Mish, how low can it go?
Not good at all, George, here. And this is, we've talked about this how many times. I've expressed my concerns about escalating trade wars. The yield curve is plunging like mad into negative territory, more inversions. The U.S. declared China a currency manipulator. This all started, curiously, 4 days ago. Trump said that he thought talks with China were going well. At the same time, he put 10% tariffs on all the rest of Chinese goods. Now, the significance of that, George, is that this last 10% is on consumer goods. So it's not on steel where, you know, maybe they can pass it on or eat the cost or whatever. This is on toys. This is on diapers. This is on refrigerators. This is on appliances. This is on everything that's going to have a direct impact on consumers right at a time when global manufacturing is struggling. I believe we're in a manufacturing recession. If the U.S. is not in recession now, I think these tariffs are going to do it. So, you know, jeez. China retaliated. Trump was doing all of this talking about trade wars being good and easy to win. George, what do you think?
China devalued its currency, and because of that, Wall Street panicked, and they think there's going to be a currency war. I hope better heads prevail on this one, Mish.
George, there's no doubt that we're in a currency war right now. If we're not in one, what else could this possibly mean? I had been hoping that this kind of thing would not happen, but we talked about it, and here we are. And now we've gone from just yesterday, I posted some charts on my blog where there was traders thought that there was a 50% chance of, you know, one cut by December. Now we're talking about four cuts
by
December.
Exactly. Mish, thanks. Put that on your blog, if you would, a little explanation of what a currency war is. We'd like to see that. Thanks, Mish. The ancient Maya were involved in extremely violent warfare long before previously thought, according to new evidence suggesting a thriving city was completely obliterated at its peak. In a study published in Nature Human Evolution, researchers examined an ancient hieroglyphic inscription of a Maya city that was located in what is now northern Guatemala. According to Newsweek, the writing reveals a series of military campaigns against another kingdom, with the inscription saying, "The city burned for the second time." Interesting story. Mass sighting of a UFO over Cincinnati. We've got that story in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. Mystery lights filmed vanishing from sight all over the place. It's a great story. Go take a look. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, George, and wow, what a big action-packed program we have here. Boy, I'll tell you something. Up here in Sedona, sharing the night sky with so many people, what a beautiful night, even though we get our summer monsoons. But interesting, George, from the world of the space historical side, Neil Armstrong's 89th birthday would have been today. It is today, as he, of course, is remembered as the first man on the moon, an incredible story, which we'll always want to talk about. But, George, lots of things are happening with people watching these beautiful sunsets. A few weeks ago, I was describing some of these fires that were happening in high northern latitudes in which smoke was appearing in the sky and people could see these colorful sunsets. Well, let's add to that some volcanic activity since June that's been taking place in a large island chain known as the Kurile Islands, the Kamchatka Peninsula, as we talk about the northern part of Russia. Simply this, George, if people look into the skies, and they're seeing this all over the listening area, the skies are now seemingly giving us some purple effects in the sky, all due to high ash content in the sky. So if you're looking into the skies in the morning sky or evening sky, and you see a purplish sky with some yellow tendrils of material, know that it's probably volcanic dust, smoke, and so many other things to obscure the sky, but beautiful nonetheless. George, in the live sky, which we always end off on, I want to make a recommendation for all of our listeners. With the full moon coming up on August the 15th now, it's still a good time, that is, to look to the northeast sky just before sunset and into the early morning hours before sunrise for any of these bright Perseid meteors. We're getting reports of bright Perseids that are appearing after midnight, looking into the northeastern part of the sky, and do it soon because the first quarter moon by the 9th will wash out pretty much all in the sky. For sky watchers in the morning sky, we finally talk about this, George. The planet Mercury is at its best elongation. What it means is if you look into the northeast sky by an hour before sunrise, you'll get to see the innermost planet, the planet Mercury. If you have questions, we've got answers. Give me an email and send me one at drskyshow@gmail.com. And above all, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies.
Thank you, Stephen. I always love your reports. Really love them. Again, makes you want to run out and get a telescope. In a moment, Matt Richtel back with us on Coast to Coast. We're going to be talking about a lot of things he's been doing. His latest book is called The Man Who Wouldn't Die. We're going to talk about high technology. Could you leave your cell phone home for one day and get by the day? One of the things we'll talk with Matt about when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Matt Richtel back with us, reporter at the New York Times. He received the Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for a series of articles he expanded into his first nonfiction book, A Deadly Wandering, a New York Times bestseller, by the way. A Deadly Wandering tells an intimate story of a fatal car crash. Was named a best book of the year by the San Francisco Chronicle, Christian Science Monitor, Winnipeg Free Press, and the Amazon as well. Matt has appeared on NPR's Fresh Air, PBS's NewsHour, and another major media outlets, including Coast to Coast, where he was with us a few months ago. Matt, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
I am so well. How are you, George?
Great, great. Everything's cooking along here. And you have been busy, my friend.
Well, you know, life is short. You got to go for it, right?
Yep, you sure do. You sure do. You've got a novel, The Man Who Wouldn't Die. Tell me a little bit about that before we get into a lot of the topics we're going to talk about tonight.
George, I've been on here a few times. I realize I've got a very serious side. I wear the New York Times cloak, but occasionally you got to let go.
Yep.
The Man Who Wouldn't Die is a, after years of taking Silicon Valley very seriously, very dutifully writing down notes and quotes, I decided to skewer the place. The Man Who Wouldn't Die begins with a tweet from a dead giant of Silicon Valley tweeting from the afterlife saying, "I've been murdered." And this is the story of whether Silicon Valley is discovered eternal life, and the detective hunt in comedic fashion to find out what happens.
This may not be fiction. This may be the real thing.
I know. You know, this is the problem with writing fiction these days. You write fiction, and 20 minutes later, it happens.
It really does.
Have a little fun with it. And by the way, speaking of creative jaunts, will you promise me one thing, George, before tonight ends?
I will give you my word, sure. What's the promise?
Can we talk about Shafika before this night ends?
My aunt, of course.
Okay, because
my late aunt, really, I should say.
Your late aunt. I hope we can. I don't know how many of your listeners know, but we got to break. We got it. When we're talking creativity, we got to talk Shafika.
We sure do. Breakthrough to creativity. One of the classics. Hey, I got to ask you about the New York Times for a second. When they broke that story of the Navy pilots, the jet fighters chasing the Tic Tac UFOs. What was the reaction in the newsroom? Did people take it seriously? I mean, when the Times comes out with a story like that, it becomes a real story.
Yeah, I mean, I sure did. And I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, there, you know, on your show, you guys take on a whole bunch of different topics, and you bring in lots of viewpoints. But in the Times, there's kind of a very serious, conventional look at the world. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yep, sure is.
And so it certainly shook me when I read it in there, and I started to go do a lot of reading about it because I said, well, I got to pay attention to this. This looks more than coincidental to me.
It's a great story, and I, you know, if we can keep up with it and have the support of the Times behind us as we all try to unravel these stories, we may be onto something.
Well, I do think that one of the things that people mistake about the Times is they think that it's a place that is locked in an ivory tower. And there's a distinction between the editorial page, the people who form opinions and write about them, and those of us who are reporting, we're really listening. And there's a lot of remarkable stuff going on in the world, and we're trying to have our ears to the ground.
And I got to tell you, I worked for the Pulitzers in St. Louis back in 1979 for a couple of years. They owned a television station here in St. Louis at the time. And, of course, you won a Pulitzer Prize. I got to tell you, Matt, I pray every day that newspapers stay, that they don't get eroded away, that they don't get, you know, chopped up by the Internet. We need newspapers and reporters because no media covers stories like newspaper reporters.
May I share an anecdote I heard from the publisher of the New York Times on a conference call the other day?
Sure.
So he said, to your point, he said he went out, this is the publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, he goes out to speak to a bunch of well-informed journalism students, we do some questions with readers, and we say, you know, when we report a story out of, you know, Tanzania or Russia, Moscow, Washington, wherever, where do you think that information comes from? And the feedback from readers was, well, you just republish what other people have said from there. And it was shocking to the Times because many people don't realize we have a reporter in each of those places. Every time we write a story with a byline from someplace, we are there, a dateline, we are there. And to your point, we need people who are there, not just repeating information that comes from some other source. We are verifying it.
Without reporters, we never would have had Nixon fall apart. Woodward and Bernstein wouldn't have been around to do what they did. And so many other stories that newspapers have broken in local markets and in national. And what really concerns me too, Matt, is the newspapers in local markets, because of the economy and the lack of advertising revenue, they're going to get hit and get hit hard. I mean, I've seen already the Post-Dispatch, which was like one of the Bibles of newspapers. It is paper thin now, and it's really sad.
There was just a note even the other day, a big story that went out about the Los Angeles Times and how much duress that, you know, that Regal paper is under. You know, as more people go online and spend their time surfing from one site to the next, it is very hard for a particular news source to keep and gain its readership and keep and gain the advertisers that support it.
Yep, absolutely. Well, you let the folks know at the Times you've got our support, and whatever you have stories that you need to share with the world, you let me know. We'll get your reporters on.
Well, I appreciate that. It's much better than the made-up nonsense of my comedic fiction.
Yeah, but you know what? There's a place for that, too. Yeah, there really is. Let me ask you this. This is the question I posed before you came on, and that was, how many people can leave their cell or smartphones home for one day and get by? And I got to be honest with you. I don't think I could. I mean, I'd want to see who's texting me, what messages I have. My smartphone has become my portable office. It's a computer, and I need it. How many people can get away with that? I don't think a lot of people could leave it at home.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, George, because it really speaks to the moment in time we're in. I have just written, it has not been published yet, I'll tell you, though, a piece about how to a five-day effort to find some space from your phone that goes in bits and pieces till you work up till a day. And let me just address for 1 second why a day is so hard.
Sure.
The reason a day is so hard, and I'd almost caution people against thinking about it, is that the phone has become a source of economic survival.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the chief reason a day is difficult, because that phone call may be, hey, Matt, Coast to Coast wants to have you on tonight last minute. I can't afford to miss that. Or it may be your boss saying something. It may be a journalism source. George, it may be some incredible guest opportunity for you.
It may be a family member who has a problem.
That is, I suppose, under the highest level, you could call that economic need as well. The thing about the device is it has become almost inseparable from survival. That said, may I suggest a couple of tiny ways to steal back some time in your life so that you can begin to acclimate to being less dependent on your device?
Absolutely. Hold on for the break. We'll come back and we'll pick it up right from there, Matt, and then we'll get into your work. The man who wouldn't die. We'll talk about some of the things going on in Silicon Valley. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, back with Matt Richtel. His book is The Man Who Wouldn't Die. We'll get into that in just a second here. Matt, we were talking about smartphones and people leaving them at home for a day. Nobody could, and you had a couple pointers here.
Yeah, this is my first bit of, the first bit of advice you'll read in this column I'm going to have out shortly in the Times is, you know those campaigns where they say take back the night or take back Capitol Hill? Okay, this is called take back the checkout aisle. This is all you got to do, George. Ready?
Here we go.
You know, this is it. I'm going to give you science behind this, my friends. When you're standing in the checkout aisle or any of those moments you're waiting in line, you know how you immediately go to your phone for no apparent reason?
Mm-hmm.
You just don't.
Don't do it.
I want you to sit with yourself in a moment of silence in the checkout aisle, in line someplace.
Or a bank teller line.
All of the above. Why? Because one of the things we've lost touch with is staying in the moment without diverting our attention to a quick hit of dopamine from our device. And there is real science to back up the idea that your creativity, your ability to synthesize ideas, in a sense, your intellect comes from moments of quiet that you are giving away. You are giving them away to the eyeball economy, to Silicon Valley, to advertisers. Take back the checkout aisle, and from there, baby steps to work up to half a day.
Interesting. And let me tell you the toughest place to do that, waiting for a plane in an airport terminal.
The single toughest place, the single place where I do so much of the baseline observation for my research about people's interaction with their devices is, you're so right, George, sitting in an airport. You cannot make eye contact with anybody. You could crawl up to them underneath their phone and gently push it aside, and they wouldn't see you.
Some of them have it plugged in. They're charging them. But you look at a line of 20 people sitting in their chairs waiting for the boarding, and all of them have their cell phones out. I mean, all of them. I've never seen anything where the percentage was so high.
And look, let me add another little bit of this is more anecdotal than science, but bear in mind, as you know, George, I've spent a lot of time studying how people use their devices and how compelling, if even addictive, they might be. One thing that's happening in that environment is there's an enormous amount of stress. And the phone provides an even double layer of escape. It's more than the checkout aisle where you're merely just bored. You're worried, is my plane on time? Is the person going to be there to meet me? You know, a trip is inherently stressful. One of the reasons we use our devices so often is they provide the momentary escape of must-see TV. So that's another place. That's another place where people ought to challenge themselves to live in the moment absent their devices. You may discover something about yourself or your environment that's very powerful.
The Man Who Wouldn't Die is Mr. Matt Richtel's fictional book. The book starts with someone tweeting from beyond the grave saying that he's been murdered. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, first of all, I have to wall off my new identity. I have written this book under a pen name. The pen name is A.B. Jewell. The reason that the A is for my daughter's middle name, Anne, B for Benjamin, my son's middle name, and Jewell is my wife's middle name. The reason I did that is I have taken on a new identity in this book. I am usually, you know, dutifully writing down everything people say in Silicon Valley and writing news stories. But at some point, you got to laugh, George. And where did this idea come from? Well, believe it or not, people in Silicon Valley believe they're coming up with that they're going to solve life eternal.
Yeah.
You've heard of singularity, yeah?
Absolutely. And they may. I can't rule it out.
They can't rule it out. So I'm going to actually explain. So this is a comedic book. There's a guy who tweets, I've been murdered. from beyond the grave. The detective who gets it is named Fitch, and he has to go through the craziness of Silicon Valley to figure this out. But can I touch on the real science that's behind this idea?
Sure. Love to hear it.
All right. So first of all, there's this idea that people in Silicon Valley talk about where the computational will meet the biological. And depending on who you ask or what you read, this could mean a variety of different things. But one way to think about it is that computer intelligence will become so profound, so powerful, so remarkable that that it will be able to, if not replace, then fully complement human beings by, some people predict, say, 2050. Let me tell you one reason I doubt, George.
Let's hear.
When I was covering distracted driving, people would say, well, what if you use hands-free to get, say, to call on your phone or to get directions? You know how you talk to Siri?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you go look at the scientists, one reason people get so distracted is because they wind up arguing with Siri because Siri can't understand them.
So that's like, true.
No, I didn't say McDonald's. I said I wanted to go home. So when I start thinking about the promises that Silicon Valley makes and the reality, for instance, how much has Silicon Valley changed the world? A lot. But you know what the 6th, 7th, and 8th most surfed on websites are? Take a guess.
Let me see.
Well, it's
movies, TVs? Or can we even say it on the radio?
I can't say the names of them, but it's adult content.
I was going to say that, but I was playing Pontius Pilate on that one, Matt. I was going to wash my hands of that one.
I'm sorry. I have.
I would have been right. I didn't want to say it.
Yeah, make me be the bad guy.
That's right.
So my point being that there is a disconnect at times between the promise and the reality. That said, I would like to introduce some science here, if you want, and I'm always wary of the commercial break, but the science behind the idea of how we might keep someone's soul alive eternally using computers. That is, there's a theory in this book, as comedic as it is, about how Silicon Valley's achieved that. Should I go into that?
Yeah, because they are they not experimenting now with trying to download memories and things like that on a chip?
I mean, there are efforts to do that, but the reality is that the human brain on some level, well, let me tell you what we do know, why on some level it actually is doable. There used to be a thing, or there still is, a thing called the Turing test. This was a test where you wanted to see how lifelike a computer program could be. And just oversimplifying it here, George, there would be a computer behind one curtain and a human behind one curtain, and a human subject would ask questions of each and try to determine which was the human. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the reasons why you kind of marvel at it. You go, well, how could you mimic a human? But then you realize something about humans that's quite powerful and has stuck with me for a long time and helped me make some of the comedy in this book work, is that humans actually are not that unpredictable. George, you probably, when you go to a dinner party, I bet you tell the same 30 stories or so, even if you're in different audiences, you've got kind of some go-to keys. I have some go-to stories. People are kind of rote. Let's say 95% of us is the same most of the time. That makes us relatively easy to predict. There might be only a fraction of the time that we are so unique, so singular, so individual, that it would qualify as distinguishing us from a computer. Are you with me?
I'm with you, of course. And that happens to me, too. You know, I do these various events all over the country. But because I'm in different cities, I can use a lot of the same material over and over again.
And make it sound really fresh.
Absolutely.
I do speaking events.
Yep.
It would be insincere to your audience not to acknowledge that we are in our own way have a lot on save get key or cut and paste.
Mm-hmm.
That we and so when I start to see these new Gmail programs where they give you suggestions of what to send back, you know, do you use Gmail, George?
Once in a while.
Okay, so on Gmail now, they will your email will be scanned essentially by artificial intelligence, and then some suggested answers will pop up.
Jeez.
So effectively, they are discerning or inferring from your language or someone else's what you may want to say.
Well, is it like Alexa, basically? You can talk to Alexa.
You can talk to Alexa. Alexa is starting to make real inferences about you, not because Alexa's so smart, although she is awfully smart relative to what we had even 5 years ago, but also because we are fairly predictable. And the more data we gain on human beings, the more predictable the computer world realizes we are. So in this book, The Man Who Wouldn't Die, there's reason to believe that our innovator in Silicon Valley actually has sent a tweet from beyond, and our detective has to go figure out, well, is he dealing with murder or the afterlife? The Man Who Wouldn't Die.
There was a story, you can use this for one of your future books, that an individual had told his family, when I die, I want you to put my cell phone in the coffin because in case I'm really not dead, I want to be able to call somebody to come get me. And they said, sure, sure. And they both laughed. The daughter laughed and thought it was a joke. The son thought he was serious. The guy dies.
I think I made a joke in the book where when the main character, Jimmy Kimmel, says of the main character who says he's going to live forever, he's like, I don't care if you can live forever. Just make my cell phone battery last.
Exactly. Well, listen to this. The guy dies, and now the family's arguing, are we really going to put a cell phone in his coffin? And the daughter said, don't do it. The son said, yes, let's do it. They ended up putting the cell phone in the coffin. They buried the guy. He's not dead. He wakes up. And he goes, oh, my God. Oh, my God. He feels around, and he feels the phone. He said, oh, my God, they did it. They did it for me. Flips it open, and it says no service. That's a joke.
That's so good.
You can use that at one of your things.
I don't know if it's a joke, George.
It might be real.
It might be real.
It might be real. But Silicon Valley is making incredible inroads. You know, for example, if somebody's lonely, get an Alexa, because you can almost carry on a conversation with that thing. It's weird.
Yeah. It's weird, and there are a lot of mixed blessings. I mean, today we're starting to see some anecdotal evidence of teen depression and anxiety associated with heavy tech use because it can come at the expense of getting outside or interacting in person. On the other hand, there are really some extraordinary, I just, as much as I have fun with it in this book, we are at a marvelous time and place. You speak of loneliness. I mean, think of the simple notion of Uber coming to an old person's home who can no longer drive to take them to a social event.
Yeah, just with a quick app, just with an app, just like that.
Yes, with an app, or eventually that will be a self-driving car that will create mobility for people who are locked in places. I mean, it's really hard to find one way or another against Silicon Valley. I mean, it's just too nuanced of a place. But it definitely deserves to have its funny bone poked at a little bit.
You know, the taxi companies, and I respect our taxi drivers. They're hardworking people. The taxi companies missed the boat. They should have done what Uber did with the taxis.
Well, I mean, you can make the case that Uber is one of the exceptional examples of an industry that had grown, that had really rested on its laurels. And there are places where technology is not nearly as grand as the makers of it would say, but that is a perfect example of, I don't know about you, but I remember nights waiting and waiting for Yellow Cab or whatever to show up.
Oh, yeah, that's happened.
Signal.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing that's so interesting about it is it's created some of these some of these kind of freelance, if you will, or gig economy jobs have really put an emphasis on service. So the Uber driver is highly incentivized to be a decent person because the tip and his or her income goes with it.
That's right. Is Uber in New York City where the place is flooded with cabs?
You know, well, I'm based in San Francisco, and tonight I am speaking to you from my native Colorado.
Uh-huh.
I have been in New York at times for the paper, and I do remember taking Uber, but I suspect, I think the same thing is happening there. I think there's enormous competition for those. It's just a slightly different place, but I've yet to go to a spot in the United States, and my travels are fairly big, where you can't find Uber and Lyft now.
And the technology is amazing. I mean, one, you turn on your phone's GPS, they find you, and then you can also monitor that car that's coming to get you, because they have a little tiny picture of the car coming down the street on a map, and you can see exactly where it is. You know, it's 2 minutes away. It's a minute away. Here it comes. It's unbelievable.
No, it's made. There is a way in which life has been gamified. Like, you can keep track of almost everything. How fast is it coming? What can I do faster? I joke in this book that someone has, at some point, all the drivers in Silicon Valley have gotten very good, but it's not because they're paying attention to their driving. It's because they have started to pay attention to a game on their dashboard that mimics their driving. And they're much more interested in the game of driving than the actual driving, but it gets them to pay attention.
I believe it. It's just truly remarkable what technology is doing. And Matt, where's it going to go? We're coming up to a break. We'll come back and talk more. Let's talk about where is technology going to be the next 10 years from now, and then we'll get into some more of your work. Matt Richtel with us, of course. His book is called The Man Who Wouldn't Die. He's got a number of books out there, by the way. When he was on with me in April of this year, we talked about an elegant defense as we talked about immune systems. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And, yeah, we'll take your phone calls, too.